As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
This is The Athletic Baseball Show on The Athletic Podcast Network.
Greetings and welcome to Starkville.
Baseball Hall of Famer Jason Stark.
And then the robot said, strike.
That's why you're going in the Hall of Fame.
It's an inside the park home run, Doug Glanville.
Mike Trout is coffee at Starbucks with a double latte skinny.
Doug, are you ready to make some podcast magic?
I am ready. Bring on the magic wand. Let's do it.
Greetings and welcome to Starkville, now part of the Athletic Baseball Show, where you'll find great baseball talk all week long and all season long. I'm Jason Stark. I write about baseball for The Athletic, and I am joined once again by my good friend, writer, broadcaster, professor, distinguished former major leaguer, and the voice of Sunday Night Baseball on ESPN Radio, Doug Glanville. So Doug, as usual, you're joining us after another fun day of travel. I was curious. You had a fine Chicago this weekend, and they had a monsoon there. Like the Bears played a game where all 22 guys in the field were underwater. Then a baseball game at Wrigley went off a few hours later. Looked like just another normal night in the summer. How did that happen?
Yeah. Nothing like good scuba gear. That's the key. It was pretty bad. We knew about the storm. We were thinking that it was not likely the game would get in. So I was in New York doing the Rays Yankees, and it was a day game. So I flew out right then to get to Chicago just so I was there. And woke up. I do my early breakfast thing down the street, and it started pouring when I was walking back. And I actually had an umbrella, and pretty much from my thighs down through my shoes was completely soaked. It was like I jumped in a swimming pool on Michigan Avenue. I was like, what was the umbrella for? I think that actually made it worse. So, those sneakers right now are drying out back here. It's going to take a while, but try to put them in the dryer or something. I mean, it was crazy. But then all of a sudden, game time right before, it was like just stopped. It kind of, it was a little black clouds, but it kind of cleared. So, it was totally on time. And so that was wild. Reminded me of New Orleans in AAA. We had the dugout. I was sitting in the dugout and I was watching it go halfway up the wall. And pretty soon the benches, it was a swimming pool in the dugout, and needless to say, that game was canceled. So, but we tried to hang in there. But yeah, it was pretty bad in Chicago. I know David Cohn flew in the same day and they told him, the announcement was like, you are the last flight from New York to Chicago.
Wow.
Because he just made it. So we were getting ready like, okay, who's going to call the game if Coney can't get here? So
wow.
He pulled it off. Yep.
Somebody, could be you, needs to invent an umbrella that goes from head to toe or head to shin or something, right?
But yeah, especially if you're above 6 feet. Yeah, it's a bad situation. Yeah, it's not made for you.
Okay, enough about the weather. We have a fantastic show again this week. Joey Votto of the Reds, the most interesting man in baseball, will join us. I want to ask him about these rule changes, about what he's up to on social media and all sorts of fun stuff. But Doug, I also want to ask him about the subject of last week's show, which was analytics and the things that Joe Maddon had to say about it all. And, you know, I don't know about you, I have never experienced the reaction to any show that we've done that even came close to approaching the response to that Joe Maddon show. It took until a weekend before I stopped hearing from like 10 baseball people a day reacting to Joe, telling us that while he doesn't have a problem with analytics, he does have a problem with how some of these front offices are delivering the analytics to the players, to the coaches, and obviously to the managers. So if you have missed this, let's hear a little excerpt again, and then we can talk about it.
I mean, you have to be philosophically aligned. You have to be able to disagree. You have to be able to argue. And you have to be, as a manager, left alone also when the game begins. Because if groups only want middle managers, I'm not going to fit anymore. I won't. And I get that. And that's fine. I mean, there's nothing I could do about that. But if somebody wants somebody that actually manages and has an understanding of how a game runs and the ebb and flow of the game and has experience, then I'll be the person for that group. So again, I got to wait and see how this is received. And I think that's going to give me direction moving forward. And I've been so passionate about this game for so many years. And to be sitting here right now and not even wanting to watch it on television, I'm trying to figure out, what does that mean?
I don't know about you, but most of the baseball people that I heard from were mostly in Joe Maddon's corner on this. Definitely not everybody. Some people in front offices, I would say they're kind of offended, not surprisingly. But, you know, I heard from managers, coaches, scouts, players, former players, all across the spectrum. When we talked with Joe, I honestly wasn't sure how much of what he was telling us was his experience and how much of it was universal across the game. But a week later, after hearing from all these people, it's pretty clear to me he's not the only one who sees it how he sees it. I'm curious, what happened in your corner?
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, you think about, this is a topic that comes up a lot, and it has for
a lot.
Years in some form. I think it's that moment the dam broke, right? It's like the insider who was just freshly in the managerial chair, you know, really kind of called out what he believed to be the game going in the wrong direction and losing him as a fan, or at least maybe temporarily. Yeah. I think that's a different animal. And when you have someone who won the World Series, was successful many years, and did beat to his own drum, no question about it. I mean, remember, I interviewed for the Rays job after Joe Maddon left. And, you know, the Rays were great. And, you know, they got Kevin Cash, an incredible manager. But there definitely was concern in that whole dialogue around how they're going to move forward off of Joe Maddon, who had, you know, a different style. And there's no question that there was an interest in communication between the front office and the manager, or at least better or direct. And how hands-on, you know, that's a big question. And so you can see how, yes, the game is, you know, a lot of players, former players, you know, David Rosses of the world, there's a apprenticeship that happens now that's very different. You see, you know, they say, okay, this guy is a player, former player at the right age, good with the media and so on, can manage people. But now we're going to put him in an apprenticeship to kind of get him accustomed to our methodology, our approaches. So you have a lot more of that than like, oh, I'm going to come up through the minors and coach in A-ball and coach in the manager in winter ball and so on, where you get this organic instinct as a manager to be able to make your own decisions and develop and so on. And Maddon is from that school. So, you know, it's the pendulum swing, and we kind of were wondering when that pushback will come in this kind of form. So I found that people have brought this up, and I've sent it to a ton of people. All the games that I've been to, whether it's Tony Gwynn Jr. and, you know, the feedback has been, there's been the quiet part has been said out loud kind of feeling. And not to say that everybody agreed 100%, but it's just like, it's a very important conversation about where we're trying to go with this. I think you have to have this conversation. And, you know, look, I have a student who I taught at Penn in the School of Communication a few years ago, who's now part of the Mets front organization on the analytics side. He does Major League Baseball strategies. This is a great kid, and he cares about not only the numbers and that fascination, but he cares about the social impact. So I do think if he's an indicator of where the young people in this game can take it, then I am hopeful that they'll find a better balance and find a way to make the humanity still stand out. This isn't the last conversation on it. And I do think the game will continue to try to adapt. And that's what I found from the feedback and talking to people. They really care about this and they want the game to, you know, retain a certain soul to it. And I think because generally people feel strongly about that, I think they will. It's just going to be a lot of growing pains in that process.
Yeah, now you're exactly right. Joe started a conversation. He started a big debate. It's what he set out to do. It's why he talked to us. It's why he said what he said. He thinks it's important to have that debate. Now, I would say that the part that people in the game were most unhappy with was when he used the term, this is a quote now, real baseball people, unquote, to describe a lot of longtime scouts and coaches, people like that, who have been pushed out of the game in the last few years. And I understand what he was saying, but I also think most likely if he had a chance to rephrase that part of this, he would. Because look, he knows that Perry Minassian, his general manager with the Angels, has spent his whole life in baseball. So he wouldn't want to imply that someone like Perry isn't a real baseball person. That's something I don't think he intended. Perry joined our show a couple of months ago and listened to him tell his tales. He spent his whole life in baseball. I talked to lots of people in modern front offices whose background was not former player or coach. Let me attest, they love baseball. They care about baseball 24/7. They absolutely are real baseball people. So again, I don't think Joe meant to imply that. I know what he was trying to say. But Doug, I'm curious, what was your reaction to that part?
Yeah, you know, well, there's two parts to it. One of which is this isn't, and I think I said this in the podcast, like this isn't just a baseball problem. You know, this isn't just a baseball challenge in terms of trying to figure out efficiencies and money management and all the things that make a business successful and balancing that with like how you're, you know, going to have humanity at the center of it, right? You know, these algorithms and the mechanics of it sometimes show really great ingenuity. Like, here's one way I appreciate it. You know, yeah, I want, you know, when I interviewed the Rays and I saw Eric Neander maybe a year later, I asked him about signing Kevin Kiermaier, and he said, never will a player like Kevin Kiermaier and his defense be underappreciated again. Like, I appreciate that, right? I think, and look, and if you go down, and something I wrote about a couple of years ago for ESPN.com about addressing inequities, right? Social inequity, racial inequity. I say, well, we have all these talented people. Why can't we point this these resources towards way to make existence for everyone fair, more fair? Like, those are good tools. When, you know, when Citigroup did that giant study on discrimination in banking, that data was important because they had the tools and the people on the ground to actually measure it. Okay, so there is no question those are important. But how you contextualize them, how you apply them, and I think in Joe's case was saying how you put them in day to day, like literally day to day, I think that's the challenge. And so, yeah, like I mentioned my student at Penn, this guy loves baseball. You know, I would never not say he wasn't a real baseball fan, but I know that he has a job to do. And when you're, you know, you're sitting there in the room trying to figure out, is it right to put Pete Alonso in this situation, which usually is the answer is yes. Well, yeah, you have to do your diligence and make sure the manager has the room to apply it. And the question is how much room? And, you know, I've seen Buck Showalter all season, all the Mets games. And he's like, yeah, I have to synthesize all this data, but I got to figure out what to kind of keep and what to sort of use, or more so what I should use in the moment. And that there's nothing exact about that. And you just don't want to lose the fact that, yes, you're trying to minimize risk all the time, right? In these numbers, we're trying to minimize risk. But we also forget that some of the greatest inspirations is because someone took risk. That's actually the point, and so how do you, that's where you feel like, oh, wow, that's really inspiring. We love the story of the underdog, the story of someone, the low percentage play that actually turns out magical. Like, why did Travis Ishikawa hit or in that situation or whatever, right? So I think you got to balance it. I do think the pendulum will keep swinging. But yeah, we have to make sure that we are good stewards of the game. And part of it is having these conversations.
Boy, no doubt about it. I'm glad you keep bringing up your job interview, your managerial job interview with the Rays, because I think many of the people who weren't happy with the way Joe said some of the stuff he said are also the people who hire managers. And that could make it challenging for Joe to get another managing job, at least with those teams. But I also think Joe delivered his message to reach people in authority who were inclined to agree with him that some of this has gone too far. Like you mentioned Buck Showalter. My impression is that the Mets, who, they're pretty data-driven right now, they do this the way Joe described how he would like to do it, that Buck and the coaches are the ones who communicate the information, and they communicate it in different ways to different people because that's how it's done. So we know there are teams who think that way. Maybe there are enough of those teams that this makes somebody more interested in hiring Joe. I don't know the answer. Joe has a lot to offer. I would certainly hope he's not done managing baseball teams. But look, we're not done with this. As he told us, his book, The Book of Joe, written with Tom Verducci, will be out next month. So one thing I know, I guarantee, we have not heard the last of this debate.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Hey, Doug, it isn't every week we get to talk to the most interesting man in baseball, but we're going to do that this week because Joey Votto has stopped by Starkville to visit us. Joey, thank you so much for joining us. How are you?
I'm good. That introduction's not even close to the truth. So bad start, guys. Really bad.
All right. So you now have a chance to disprove that you're interesting. What could go wrong?
That could be interesting, and then that would be wrong. That would be against what I assume that I'll probably end up doing on this show.
Then we'd be all mixed up, huh?
Yeah.
All right, look, I guess we better start with your health. Turns out you were playing through a torn rotator cuff, which seems hard to me. So then after you had surgery, that was a few weeks ago, you tweeted, "I didn't know I was hurt. I thought I just stunk." So tell the truth. How serious were you being there?
I was that was not terribly long after the surgery. So I was in an anesthesia fog. And the surgery wasn't just rotator cuff. I had a torn bicep. And as far as like playing through a rotator cuff injury, I tore my rotator cuff in 2015. And I remember playing through it for about 2 or 3 months, where it was like I felt like I had to work my strength back and work my mobility back, and you know, as a lot of players out there know, ball sports, you have to get through some things and hope for the best. And you don't want to miss opportunities of, you know, making the lineup, playing through some things. And so it ended up passing and it was fine. And it wasn't until this year that I started experiencing some pain sometime in June, July, more like June. And I just really had a rough time with it. And it ended up being, the real problem was I had something wrong with my hand, for sure a sprain, maybe a tear. And then the torn bicep was the real pain. Wow. Cause. And you know, when you're a right-handed thrower and a left-handed hitter, you can get away with some things on your left arm, which I have in the past. And I just kept moving forward because I thought, you know, this will pass, this will get better. And I don't need it as much. I'm not as dependent as my right arm. So the bicep was the real issue and the real cause of the real prompt to getting the surgery. So they didn't find the bicep tear until they were inside. You know, when we had the MRI done, I complained of not being able to sleep well, and I had a hard time holding the bat, and I had a hard time running, and it was just bothering me in a lot of different natural baseball movements. And they said, all right, it makes sense. Rotator cuffs cause pain, and sometimes they get to a point where you just got to move on from they just don't get better. And we decided, okay, I'll have the surgery. And I thought, man, you've played through rotator cuffs for a little bit. You're fine. Like, it'll get better, you know, move forward with it. And I just couldn't, it never got better. And I didn't play well. And frankly, if I was playing well, I would have continued moving forward. But because it was affecting my poor performance, we had to have the conversation. We elected to start the rotator cuff repair and rehab process. And while they were inside, long story short, the point of the story is, while they were inside, they saw that it was like a mess. It was like, if anybody's cut rope before and kind of pulled it apart, they said that's what my tendon looked like. It looked like, and that was the pain driver. That was most of the pain cause. And had a tendinesis, had a rotator cuff repair, and now I'm in the middle of the slow process of recovering from a bicep and shoulder repair. And something like 6 to 12 months. It takes a long time to get your range of motion back, to get your strength back. Healing takes about 10 weeks, I was told. And I'm almost done. One more thing. I hope to be back for opening day next year.
Yes.
Yeah. So.
Okay. Well, look, I know you ended up your season going 0 for your last 22, which is not very Joey Votto-like, but if it makes you feel better, when Glanville was your age, he was 0 for his last 5 years. So.
Yeah, basically.
You know, I'm sure Doug has forgotten like the in real time experience. You know, you know, it affects all of your life. Like when you're in the middle of, like, a lot of people don't understand, and we're athletes, of course, but when they say athletes experience two deaths, their own death and the end of their career, you know, when you're going through those stretches and people keep telling you it's over, you're like fighting for your life in a way. And I've never been in a position where I'm about to die or anything like that. So obviously I don't have that experience, but it hurts you to your core because it's all you've ever known. It's a strong part of your identity. And you dedicate every ounce of the ones that I'm familiar with, the athletes I'm familiar with, dedicate all of their life. Everything is built around performance. And so when you struggle, you think, you fight the, am I like less of a person? Am I not quite the person I was before? And so there can be a version of a grieving process when you're in the middle of that. And it's humbling, maybe not humbling is the right word, but it's painful. And there's the only escape you lean to in the past was performance and sport. And if that's failing you, then you've got nothing else to fall back on. You know, you better have a good social circle. And oftentimes that can be a struggle for some players just because they're so dedicated to their career. So you know, it's, I am happy that I had this injury in a way, because I was struggling so mightily. You know, I had such a strong year last year, and I just assumed that I was going to repeat that or better. And the, from the very beginning of the season, it was a struggle. I fought back hard, and then I started experiencing some like real pain. And then like, I couldn't fight back. I was like, as poorly as I started, I just assumed I was going to fight back and have a strong finish to the season, and then really be in the driver's seat as far as career decisions long term. So yeah, it was an awful experience, but
yeah, I mean,
I can't wait for the challenge.
Well, Joe, yeah, just to put some context, I had a couple of big, like 0 for 18 somewhere in there, not a whole lot, thankfully. And I often stopped the game after I got a hit, and they always were confused. I'd call timeout, and get the ball. They throw it off the field, and then everybody was confused. Like BJ Suroff was like, "What was that for? Is that your 500th hit?" I said, "No, I just got a hit.
Oh yeah,
it's been a couple weeks. I got a hit off Jason Marquis at a night game at Turner Field where I couldn't see. I got a hit off Chris Benson, who I couldn't touch, and I just stopped the game.
Yeah.
So you know, sometimes that, you know, just commemorate that memory of like, yeah, I got past this, you know. So it helped me.
If that helped you, that's good. I'm kind of the opposite school. If I get a hit and I know I've been struggling for a little bit, like if anybody even acknowledges it, like my maybe it's my ego or unhealthy pride, but if I get it acknowledged, it bothers me. I don't, my goal is to like just be so steady and to just continue to perform that if like I don't even want to play if I don't know, it's hard to explain the feeling of like it would enrage me if somebody acknowledged, hey, you haven't gotten a hit in a bit, like or person, you know, keep, you know. So yeah, but I get it. I've definitely seen that before, and it gives me a chuckle when I see guys do that, for sure.
Yeah, Miguel Cabrera did it not long ago. It was like last year, I think. So.
All right, hey, let's ease into some other stuff now. Joey, you're so entertaining on social media, and I know you're a recent entrant into the world of Twitter and Instagram and even TikTok. What took you so long, and what's your favorite part of being a social media cult hero?
I kind of don't like it that much. Yeah. You know, first of all, I think at times it can be a distraction, like a real distraction. I'm actually kind of low-key tempted not to do it next year. Just because to do, you know, I love the saying, how you do anything is how you do everything. And if I'm going to do social media, I'm going to try to do it well. But I've only got so many energy units to give out. You know, I've only got so much time. I've only got so much, like, because it takes time to recover from games and prepare for the next game. But there is that, you know, because you're on a public platform, if you send something out, you're like, how did it get received? Or should I acknowledge it? Or, you know, because you're putting yourself out there. So I don't know if I have the gas, the stamina, even the desire at times to engage in a meaningful way while I'm competing. You know, I'm here's what I'll say. Earlier in my career, I had more gas in my tank. I could compete and then do other things off the field and then know that I'm going to perform well on the field again the next day. But as I get older, it's like I use more gas per day. And so I have less gas in the tank in between games to be able to do things. And so I feel like social media burns some of that fuel. And for those with, you know, electric vehicles out there, use some of the battery. You know, I feel like I run out of battery, but I'm fine with it. I feel like I at times enjoy it, but you know, I don't want to be on stage, and really I can't truly be myself on there. If we're honest, like the way I talk to some of my friends is outrageous, but they're my friends, you know, in a good way, in a healthy way, but I would never share that with people because, you know, I just don't feel safe doing that. You know, I don't feel like context is included, you know, in that sphere. So You know, I don't know if I'll continue doing it. All I really care about at this point in my life is performance, performing well, getting back healthy and getting back to performing well, and then getting back into a position of power in terms of decision-making in my career, because there's nothing more frustrating than being a strong performer and then somebody being like, sorry, it's over. Give me that jersey sort of thing, you know? So I don't read anything from my social media. I actually found that joining social media has kept me off social media.
We understand.
You know, like I post, my rule is like post and walk away and then not check and then maybe check a little bit later. But because I actually find that's stressful, I just post and walk away until somebody else brings it up. Which is good because, again, like then I get to focus on the things that, but it's in the background. You sense it in the background. And I think of myself as a relatively sensitive person. So I feel the heat and I don't want to feel that. I want to focus on work.
So. Right. Yeah, I have four kids. So it's teenagers. And I'm like, yep, they feel the heat. If that phone is even in the room, it's like, it's deep, man. Yeah. It's deep.
Yeah. Hey, we were so excited to have you on this show for many reasons. One of them is baseball just announced a bunch of rule changes. You're so insightful in the way that you think about the game. We'd love to ask you about some of these rule changes, maybe go one at a time and hear how you think they will change life in the sport. And I'd like to start with shifts. They're banning shifts. And so I looked it up. You've been shifted on in 86% of your plate appearances this season. You've only had 51 plate appearances all season with no shift. So how excited are you about all those at-bats that you're about to get with no third baseman hanging out in right field?
You know, I'm not sure if who I spoke to on the subject about pulling the ball and attempting to hit the ball the other way. And it was someone from ESPN. It was a larger article and myself and Gallo were quoted on it. And I think I mistakenly said that it's hard to just hit the ball the other way. And I haven't had that issue in my career, but sometimes when I attempt to do things, it can be difficult to change on the fly. It's just the nature of our some of the players' skill sets. Like once you build a style, you attempt to repeat that style over and over and over. And when the league or defense when the league asks you to change, it can be difficult to just change on a dime. And so I said, well, I said something about opportunity costs and, you know, if you're grooving your swing, basically if you're grooving your swing a particular way and you're getting results and high end success out of it, it's hard to attempt to like just hit the ball the other way. I was mainly talking about hitting the ball hard on the pull side. And I think I was wrong because I do think that hitters are malleable. I think that hitters can create a style kind of on the fly. And that's what makes the good ones good in this league. They can adapt to the challenges. So I think hitting the ball the other way and hitting the ball to counter the shift, I think is an important skill. I think it's an important skill to have for the good hitters, for all major league hitters, but especially those that want to perform well, the left-handed hitters. And we're even seeing it a lot for right-handed hitters. You asked me the question about how it'll affect me. You know, I'm realizing that to be successful as a hitter, I have to hit the ball the other way. And I'm learning that through failure. Earlier in the season, I was trying to pull the ball a lot. I switched my bat. I started using a knob bat that a lot of the hitters are using these days. I tried to practice all my work down the right field line. I was basically gunning for 50 home runs because I was like, all right, I hit 36 last year in 129 games. Well, if I just pull a few more left-handed pitchers on their, you know, if I time the left-handed fastball and I just pull them, I should get to 50. This is going to be easy. But it's like a trick mirror for me. I pull the ball when I master hitting the ball the other way. So next year, that's going to be my target. Like the first thing I start doing is I'm going to just focus. And I read articles on David Ortiz late in his career. An anecdote or a story he shared where Dustin Pedroia basically grabbed him by the scruff and said, if you don't hit the ball the other way, I'm going to beat the out of you, you know, sort of thing. And it's like, you know, I don't have anyone on that, on my team. I, you know, it's nice to play with veterans for that reason, which is another subject we can go into, but I wish that I have to do that to myself now. Hey dude, enough of this. Hit the ball the other way, and then you get the pulled balls. It's a very tricky thing because you think it's very counterintuitive. Anyways, long story short, I think the shift is a genuine challenge for certain hitter styles, and I think that next year. But you know, it's the sort of thing where we get rewarded based on relative competition. You know, they use the word, or the statistic, wins over replacement. Or we're competing using weighted measurements. So it really doesn't matter if I get a few more hits because everybody else will get a few more hits. So it's like, does the shift matter? No, it doesn't matter at all, because to me, it's my responsibility to counter it, because all my competition, my peers, the people I'm you know, competing for contracts or future jobs, they have to counter it also. So does it matter? No. I actually found it made me a better hitter, to be honest with you.
Yeah, well, I'm really glad that you brought this up. Raul Ibanez said something at the press conference last Friday that I've been thinking about. He said that it's baseball's hope that limiting the shift will change hitters' approach. Ground balls are going to be hits again, right? And they think maybe hitters will then decide they don't have to try to lift every ball over all those infielders, and maybe they'll go back to trying to hit more line drives and hard ground balls. So do you think that will happen? What will the cause and effect be?
Well, the one thing I noticed when I came up was how I felt like command was a priority, deception was a priority, sink, cut, run, you know, in out of the strike zone, out in the strike zone. I felt like though that was the language that was much more common when I first came up. And now the style is very powerful. Spin, velocity, strikeout, a hard break, maximizing the break on your breaking pitches, swings and misses. This is the language that I feel like is much more common now. You get paid based on strikeouts. You get paid based on decreasing walks, limiting contact. And so the hitters, it's really hard to match. You know, in the minor leagues, we used to play pepper, concentration, a focus on contact, spread the ball out, hit the ball on the ground. If you've got someone like just firing like 100-mile-an-hour fastballs in there, it's really hard to not match power with power. And so I feel at times that it'll be probably a hybrid version of today's game, where there is a real emphasis on you know, smashing the ball. But I do think we'll see a decrease in strikeouts. I do think we'll see a decrease in walks. I think we'll see more balls in play. But we're already seeing that. So I just think that the skill will continue to evolve. Guys will just get better. We're already seeing them get better. And then when you get that base hit through a hole, and you see a base hit go up the middle on a ground ball, hitters will probably shift their style to, you know what, I may gear down one, and know that if I hit the ball well, there's probably a hit out there for me. So what you're describing earlier may be a reality, but it's always going to be countered, I feel like. And we'll see if pitchers change. You know, we'll see if pitching styles change. So I can't answer that question. I'm just going off of what it's like to face today's pitchers. And you have to answer power with power. You know, the very best hitters in the game, and this is who we walk through, you know, through the metal detectors for, and buy it, you know, bring our little QR code tickets for. They're powerful. We don't have any Tony Gwynns. We don't have any, you know, we've got very few guys that appeal to the crowd with high contact, hit the hole, look at that skill. Most of our guys, our big name guys, are about to break, you know, a version of a home run record. They're going to, you know, pitch and hit. They're going to, you know, play the outfield for the Atlanta Braves. They're going to, you know, play center field for the Anaheim Angels. And these are all 600 slug guys. These are all big, powerful guys. I can't think of very many guys that don't do powerful things with the bat that are stars nowadays.
Well, Joe, you know, within that, you mentioned relativity. Do you ever, you know, have in your mind about kind of what it should look like what is that best version of that dynamic, you know, that relationship between shifting and these rules? Because, you know, yes, you are competing against each other relatively, but you're also, there's an absolute about, like, you know, sort of a pure form of the game. Do you ever think about what that is or what it could be? I mean, is it just bad for the game in general, or, you know, what's your global thought on that?
You know, it's fun cheering for a hit. You know, oftentimes we don't put music immediately after contact. You know, you make contact and there isn't some sort of like, I'm walking, you know, like it happens immediately after a tough walk at bat. And I don't know if there's a like a crowd surge, a moment where there's excitement post walk. There's a groan after a hit by pitch, but people don't understand, oh, that's really good. That's just a tear under a hit. You know, that reaction doesn't occur. But there's a loud cheer after a ground ball or, you know, sliding RBI moment or a sac fly moment. So we have to respect the fan. And sure, teams, listen, the best teams are the ones that get on base the most offensively. There's no question about that. And good offenses win championships, you know, or at least make it to the playoffs. So we have to respect that. And those come with lots and lots of walks. I mean, the Yankees were the perfect example in the 90s. I, if I'm not mistaken, they were a really strong, consistent, tough out team. And now it's much more common for teams to chase those players. But, you know, hits are fun. Hits are fun, you know, and seeing a player, you know, slide into second base after a wrap double or ground ball down the line and there's a bang, bang play at third base. This is a byproduct of balls in play. And so to me, I watch, you know, I liken the home runs, walks, and strikeouts to the three-point surge in basketball, where it felt like every game we got to watch, you know, a kick out to a corner three. And whoa, three. But really, if you watch the finals and the Warriors are an all-time great three-point shooting team, but their style of play was so beautiful. Cuts to the basket, finishes around the basket, the occasional post play. It looked like the three-point was complementing their beautiful style. And I feel like that's what the best teams now, the Braves, the Los Angeles Dodgers, I feel like those are the teams that are just so appealing to watch, because you get to watch a shortstop hit 300. You get to watch Mookie Betts, who's like a gem to watch, hit home runs, hit balls in the gap. Make, like, to me, balls in play are a good thing. You get to show the athleticism of the defenders off, and the crowd gets to cheer immediately after a hit. A hit is, you know, quite a pretty, what's the word? It transcends all languages. You know, everyone understands a hit.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, one example I mentioned from time to time is I was watching a Denver Nuggets game, and they had like a 3-on-1 with time running out, and they were down by two.
I know.
And you know where it's going? And they doubled Murray, I think. The one guy kind of came from behind. So Murray threw a cross court to the corner three. The guy kind of bobbled it, and instead of driving to tie the game, he backed up to the three-point line and shot and missed in the game, and they lost by two. So that's the first thing that comes to mind. And, like, when you prioritize something, like, the outcome so much, then like you said, well, the trade-off sometime of taking a lot of pitches or what, you might strike out more or whatever it is. I'm curious to, you know, think about like how does that example sort of tie to what you're saying? Like when you prioritize it so much, what do you think baseball loses?
I don't know. I was guilty of it for a while. I mean, most of my career involved getting on base and I had a lot of detractors. And I think with some distance, I get it. But not to make this question about me, but I'll answer from my own experience. I did it because it was home runs and hits are really hard to get. And so my best version was kind of a hybrid, getting on base, getting some hits, making the best of every at bat. So that worked for me. I think that there are some there, because it's been a league-wide trend, everybody's bought into getting deep in, not everybody, I don't want to generalize, but the zeitgeist was take pitches and walks and strikeouts come with it and homers. And I think in that situation that you're describing with the Denver Nuggets, I'm a basketball fan and I've been a basketball player since I was like eight, nine years old. I love the sports. My first love, first thing I want to do once I'm done playing is start playing basketball again. And so in that situation, it's a three-man weave in practice. It's a layup finish. It's a behind the back pass to a dunk. I remember playing, practicing with my team as a high school player. If you took a three in that situation, immediate bench. And it's like, when I first started playing baseball, it was, why are you taking so many pitches? Why are you taking that fringe pitch on the edge? Take a swing, put the ball in play. Don't strike out looking. And I don't think it's either answer, but I do think we're about to approach a really fun version of our sport where it's more athletic, where there's more balls in play, where we get to see the athleticism of certainly the infielders and the outfielders. I think it's, you know, we have a great sport and I think we're about to showcase it at its very best because it's probably been as athletic as it's ever been. But when Ronald Acuna is in right field and the third baseman is standing right in front of him, instead of seeing a diving play from him, it's a one hopper to the third baseman who throws out Freeman on a 112 rocket. And he's like, right, well, and exactly. The fans are like, instead of like some awesome play from Acuna and the interaction sort of thing. So I don't know.
I want to ask you about the pitch clock too. Basketball has the shot clock. Back before there was a shot clock, the great Dean Smith, Hall of Fame coach, his teams would get the lead and then they would stop playing. They just throw the ball around and go to that four corners thing. And in order to have a more entertaining game, a faster game, a better rhythm to a game, Basketball went to a shot clock. And now baseball is going to a pitch clock. And, you know, you're actually one of the more deliberate hitters in the game between each pitch.
In what way?
I think you're about 18 and a half seconds per pitch now with no one on base. The clock's going to force you and everybody to change that, right?
I promise you, I only take what's given to me. If they set a 10 second clock, it doesn't move. It doesn't affect me at all. I will stand there. I can stand in the box and hit post swing and then get back. I don't need the time. That's all I'm saying.
Well, that'll be everybody. Everybody will have to do that.
I was in so much pain every single at bat. I was like, oh my goodness. But no, finish your thoughts. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, it's okay. Well, I don't know that everybody is going to adjust so simply, so easily. You know, the hitter with no one on base has to be in the box, locked in on the pitcher, 7 seconds after that clock starts to tick. How much impact do you think that will have on hitters?
I don't think it matters. I think in the short term, some. In the long term, it'll become second nature. So that's all that matters. We have to improve the pace of the game. We have to improve the pace. I used to go to Raptors games in Toronto, the team in Toronto, and I had season tickets. And, you know, the GO train's in the center of the city. The train is in the center of the city. It's called the GO train. And it takes you to whatever neighborhood. You could take the TTC, which is the downtown metro. And, you know, I would sit in my seat and I'd look up at the clock and it would be 7:30. And I knew that at 10 p.m. I was going to leave my seat. If there's overtime, it may be 10:15, but that's extra basketball. That's usually fun, a good reason to stay. But I knew that if finished in regulation, no matter the timeouts, no matter the score, no matter what, I was leaving at 10 o'clock, 2.5 hours. They asked me to stay and be entertained for 2.5 hours. So that meant I could take a peek at the GO train schedule. I could take a peek at the TTC schedule, and I needed to hustle a little bit to make this train, or I could pace myself to make this, you know, metro or whatever it was, depending on which direction I was going. You know, if you're a fan at home and you've got kids or you have school the next day, or if you have whatever it is, you don't know if our game's going to end at 9:45 or 11:45. And there's some charm to that. But if we're asking every single night, the fan at home, every single night to stay up till 10:30, to stay up till 10:45 on a standard issue, 9-inning win, we're asking more than we asked of them 12 years ago. And it's changed substantially. So to me, as far as comfort, we're here to serve. We are players here to serve. And I understand there has to be, like, I do get, you have to respect the player and it's his process, and respect, you know, their players need a tempo, but tempos can be adjusted. You know, we are capable to make this adjustment and still perform well. And so I love it. I love that there's going to be a pitch clock. There will be some growing pains, no question about it. There will be some, but we're watching the pitchers walk off the field and have the umpires interact with them. They give up 7 runs, or they strike out the side on 9 pitches. They still have to interact with the umpire. That's a challenge to them, but they've adapted. They've accepted it. They can go in some, you know, la la land where they just basically make contact with the umpire. The same thing will happen with the pitch clock, and the fan benefits from it. The fan knows today's game is going to be done in 2 hours and 40 minutes. I think it's wonderful. I wish that it had been instituted throughout my career, to be honest with you, because I feel like I've played an additional 50 games over the last 10 years with how long these games have been. I mean, the change has been, like, significant. So,
yeah, no. So if you look at, you know, a bunch of rules we're talking about, is there anything you think the league or the fans are missing? Like if you could circle something and say, you know what, this would make a better game. This would be a good move to make for this game to really be entertaining and sustainable.
I loved what they did with the baseball this year. I thought the home runs were getting out of hand. So I'm happy they changed that. You know, I think my last check, home runs were at like 1.07 per game, I think. And last year and the year before were somewhere around 1.3, 1.25 to 1.4, somewhere in that range.
Yeah, we're back in the range of like 2015, 2016, as opposed to where we were.
I think 16 was like 1.2. And then
2015 is probably more like
close to 15. But my understanding is there was a ball change mid 2015. So, like,
right.
I think we're starting to creep more towards like a nice place to be. But we also, with the shift change, may see a dip down below one with players deciding, as opposed to attempting a home run, I'm going to take line drive shots because I'm going to go 3-for-4 today instead of 1-for-4 with a home run after four home run attempts. We as hitters, you know, we go where we get fed. And so I would guess we're going to see a home run dip again, which is fine. I mean, the game will have more hits and we'll start seeing guys hit 350 and lots of guys hit, you know, 280 and above, and then more hits and more balls in play. I think it's a great thing. So I, as far as changes, you know, I love the base. I love that they're changing the base, and we haven't touched on that, but anything to make the game more athletic, seeing guys attempt stolen bases or attempt first to thirds. I love it because I think that with extra, you know, those few inches, all of a sudden you're choosing the faster guy as opposed to the home run guy sort of thing. And so I think that it's, I love the base. I've used the base on a rehab and I think it's fun. I think it's fun. I don't know. I think they may have instituted, excuse me, for safety reasons, but I think it may make the game faster. So we'll see.
Yeah, well, you know, there's another element to the pitch clock rule, the part that says the pitcher can't throw to first or step off more than twice per plate appearance, or that third time it's a balk if the runner isn't out. So, this is you probably saw this in your rehab option too, but I mean, this is the rate of base stealing attempts in the minor leagues is almost 3 per game. We haven't seen that in the big leagues in 100 years. So you could steal 40 bases next year, man, if you play this right.
You know, little changes like this are the reason why I've got maybe two years left. You know, I'm going to get slowed out of the game. So I'm happy to hand it off to the next group.
You know, we had Joe Maddon here last week. We had a long conversation about analytics. And let me try to characterize what he said. He said he loves information. He just thinks that managers and coaches should be the ones deciding how to present the information and not the analytics guy coming down from upstairs. I'd love to hear your reaction to that because it's been incredible how much response we've had to the stuff that Joe Maddon said.
You know, I think every organization has a different approach to analytics. So his experience may be different than certainly mine. I understand what he's saying. I have felt at times the game has become very rough, like as far as less emphasis on baseball technique, less emphasis on proper decision-making, base running, positioning. We don't see hit and runs almost ever. Bunting technique is not what it used to be. And so, you know, analytics in some ways has slowed down stolen bases, proved them inefficient, has added to the walks and strikeouts, you know, proved putting a ball in player swing too often inefficient. And so they clearly knew what they were doing. I mean, but I do think there's times where a player follows the general guideline and may be a better player and more helpful if he did it in his own way. You know, I played with Brandon Phillips for a long time and he played the game the best way he knew how, and he was a very productive player. And he may not have been an analytics darling, but I watched a player get the most out of himself. And I watched a player that would never have been motivated. I don't think he would have played any better than he played during the course of his career. And, you know, there are tons of examples out there of players that could be that. And there's certainly a lot of coaches out there that don't get to back to your question. There are a lot of coaches and managers out there that probably could be a better version of themselves and help players if they weren't so tied up with a lot of the analytics approaches. So again, there's somebody smarter out there than I to say what's the most efficient way. And they're probably figuring it out. There's some things that are just kind of a waste of time that the analytics group have more or less punted on, and it's made sense. But I do think that some coaches and managers probably could coach in a more, in a better way. Yeah. It's a tough question for me to answer because frankly, I don't care. You know, I don't coach or manage, and nobody's going to tell me what to do as a player. So I don't really hear from anybody. And, you know, so I get to just play. Now I'm under a guaranteed contract, no trade clause. I mean, what does this matter to me?
Well, I was just recently in LA. We were talking to Dave Roberts, you know, manager, and we were asking about Freddie Freeman, and apparently Freddie and this definitely happens a lot. Like guys are on the iPad. You see them have their bats and then go right. And he apparently like cleaned house on this. It's like, watch the game. So, you know, the synthesizing of data and in real time, do you see examples of forgetting what's actually out there in the pasture?
You know, I haven't. So we've got a cage in our clubhouse, and we had this same conversation collectively. Just be present for the game. And I liken it to, like, if you go to a club, let's say you go to a salsa club, and you spend all this time with a dance instructor, and you're at home dancing with the YouTube videos, and you're there, and you like have the steps, and you're feeling it. Excuse me, you're at home. And you've got it down. And but then you go to a club. And if you're thinking about all the steps, or if you're checking your YouTube, you're not feeling the energy. You're not connected to the rhythm, because the game has its own pulse, has its own rhythm. And if you don't spend time really watching the game, you're not connected to that, to the rhythm of the game. And there's so many little things you can pick up. You ask the average season ticket holder, they can tell me more about me than I could probably tell about me, just because they're sitting there watching the game, really watching the game. And the iPad is usually just a TV. It's the at-home TV shot of strikes and balls, and shows you. But if you sit and watch, you start getting a feel for tendencies. You start connecting to the rhythm of the pitcher. If you're a pitcher, you start connecting to the rhythm of the hitters. Now, I used to look over at the Phillies dugout when we played them, when they were really, really good, and they had a lot of really good pitchers. And I remember watching Maddux when I played against him. And I remember watching a lot of the real great pitchers on their opposing teams, but the Phillies specifically. I remember seeing like all of their starters just sitting there. Kershaw does this in LA. DeGrom does this in New York. Now I'm missing tons of names, you know, but I'm watching the Phillies, and I'm seeing Roy Halladay, Cole Hamels. I see Roy Oswalt, I see Blanton, and
Cliff Lee.
And they just sit there. And I watched them, and Chase Utley when he wasn't playing. And I just sit there and watch them watch the whole game. The late Roy Halladay would just sit there quietly and watch all 9 innings. And I know for sure he was gathering intel on everybody. Maybe he saw a limp in a player. Can't catch that on video. You can't see that on an iPad. Maybe he saw something in a change in a guy's stance that you see from the side that you do not see on an iPad. And you have this same luxury as a hitter to watch the pitcher to see, oh, there's a dip in velocity, or, oh, he doesn't look very comfortable. Oh, he likes that pitch, or, oh, there's a relationship between him and that umpire, and he can sense that there's things expanding or things contracting. You can't catch that on an iPad. And if you don't watch every bit of the game, you miss out on that. There's a place for iPad. There's a place for gathering, you know, info on your swing or the pitcher you're facing. But I feel like there's a lot of information to be gathered by watching the game in real time. So kudos to the Dodgers and Freddie making the game more, you know, fans want to see us just play the game naturally. I can't speak for all fans, but I'm pretty confident that if I was watching a basketball game and I was over there watching, I'm sitting on the sidelines and Lord knows I've got courtside seats, and I'm sitting there watching like the Golden State Warriors always on their freaking iPads. I'd be like, no, why aren't you cheering your guys on? There's a rhythm to that. There's a collective, you know, melding that happens with the team when you're like present for every single moment. You know, if you don't have enough by the time the game starts, if you don't have enough scouting done, if you don't know, if you don't have a swing, if you don't have the skills to match your competition, you don't belong here. You know, Dusty Baker used to say, if you ain't got it by now, you ain't never going to get it. Absolutely right. He'd say that in August. He'd say that in July. He'd say that in June. Dusty, bad. That was a bad impression of you, but all love, as you know.
Yeah, hey, I'm really glad you brought this up. One of my favorite things about Clayton Kershaw is how engrossed he is in every minute of every game, and I've never heard anybody else talk about it. So I'm glad you noticed that. And I know we got to let you go, but I want to ask you about one more guy who it feels like that's him right now, and that is Albert Pujols. Mm. I know how much admiration you have for Albert. Let me ask you, he hits a home run every day, man. You know, he's slugging 800 over the last month. He's closing in on 700 home runs. Why would this guy retire?
He you know why? And he's, first of all, he wants to, and he said he would. So yeah. that's the final answer. But, you know, I got to see him during what's probably a small percentage of his prime. You know, I watched him on television. You know, I said the other day that I thought he was one of the best three right-handed hitters of all time. And I know I miss names. Mike Schmitz has probably better statistics than him. But when I meant that, I meant he did everything hitters want to do. There's two tiers to the best hitters. It's either your Bonds, Williams, Ruth, where you get intentionally walked all the time just out of fear. And the next tier down is basically you do everything, average, home runs, you know, you drive in runs. And he was that guy for 10 years. He was like the perfect non-Bonds, Williams, Ruth batter for 10 years. He was Aaron. He was, you know, DiMaggio. He was all these great, great hitters that we, you know, that we love. High batting average. That's so desired by hitters. For so long, hitting for a high average was so desired. And he did it at the very, very best. And so for a stretch there, he was in Anaheim and he had his, he was putting in, accumulating his statistics, playing with heart for his organization that signed him, that showed him, you know, showed him love, showed him appreciation. But he wasn't the central focus of the league that he was for so long, for so, so long. And if this is his last year, I like what he's doing because finally, you know, I watched Chipper Jones, David Ortiz, Derek Jeter. I watched lots of great players have their final goodbye, and the admiration they all received was justified, but none of them were anywhere near, maybe not anywhere. None of them were in Albert's class. I mean, Albert's inner circle, Albert's an all-time great. Albert has everything you could ask for as far as a player. Not only all the individual accolades, but several time over World Series champion and no blips, responsible philanthropic member of all of the communities he's been a part of. And really he hasn't received the expected adulation and love that a typical all-time great receives. And so I love that he's performing well during this stretch because people are reminded, you know, I've got 300 and something homers. He's coming up on 700 home runs. And I'm just in awe watching him finish up with such a flourish because people get to appreciate, you know what? Albert's one of the greatest players we've ever seen. And we get to see a version of that for him to finish at 42 years old. To me, you know, I'm going to broadcast in St. Louis later this week, and I'll have the good fortune of being able to take in, you know, a stretch of baseball, 5 games over the course of 4 days with Albert Pujols in St. Louis. And I'll be able to take in the appreciation first person. And, you know, I will just feel lucky that I got to see one of the greatest players of all time and someone that I viewed as not a peer because I'm not his peer. You know, his peers are Willie Mays and Hank Aaron, and you know, I can name other all-time greats, but someone that I actually looked up to, someone I admired, and someone that made things possible. You know, I think that's the testament to how great all the great players creating new norms. You know, we're seeing it with Brady in Tampa Bay. He's making things that were not possible possible. And Albert is a perfect example of that. 22 seasons, approaching 700 home runs, 42 years old, doing it respectfully. If Albert can do it, you know, why can't you do it? You know, so I'm looking forward to taking it in, and you know, Albert, you know, is someone I have great admiration for.
So is there a lesson for you in how Albert is doing his finale? You know, as you start to think about the end of your career, when you should go out, how you should go out, like, should you go out when you're still great? Should you play as long as they'll let you play because you love to play? How are you processing all of that as you get into your upper 30s?
You know, last year was so easy in terms of performance that I thought I was going to play till I was 45. You know, I was like, oh, I'm going to play another 7 years and I'm going to play well because this is so easy what I'm doing right now. And this year flattened me. I had a bad start and I felt like I was working uphill and I was making progress uphill. So I can't say now, you know, I had a conversation with my mother and I said, you know, I think maybe two more years because I always want to be good when I play. But if I come back next year and I don't play well, then I have to fight for a job and then I have to, and it feels like the sort of finish that's kind of like doesn't pair up well with how I've played throughout my career. I've been good basically the second I entered the league, all the way, save 2019, which was a funky year, all the way up until last year. And this is the first year that I was like, whoa, what on earth is going on? Like all the plans that I had made are like dashed in a way. All of the plans that I assumed that I expected to have a better year this year than last year. And so I really want to see how next year goes, but my only goal, you know, I'm happy like ending it and walking away and being like, you know, thanks. Thank you. But really all I want to do is just play well till the time I'm done playing. Like I, the idea of holding on and accumulating statistics, like I'm never going to get to 500 home runs. I'm not going to get to 3000 hits. There's really no statistic that I'm close to that I need to continue to chase. That's not going to be an absolute slog of terrible performances over and over a number. So I just want to be an efficient player. I want to be a playable player and to be healthy. Those are the two things I care about. And, you know, I'm not in that class of the Jeters and the Ortizes and the Pujolses where they're so tied to their community, championships, big numbers. I'm not that player, but I want to be the type of player that's just like, he was just good all the whole time sort of thing. And that's really my only goal. And that will leave me with a lot of satisfaction. And then at some point I'd like to be able to just, you know, walk away. I would guess probably my best guess is probably 2 years. I would say 2 years.
So. Well, I can tell you that you were great from start to finish in this podcast, if it means anything to you. you're way more interesting than you promised you'd be.
I didn't promise it. You promised it. Oh, no. I do. You're right. I promised failure. Utter.
You delivered. You delivered well.
Yeah,
you have a future in this. You have a future in this.
Yeah, you definitely laid some doubt that you would not be interesting, but we disproved it.
I have a buddy who's like a former classmate of mine that he and I talk about doing a podcast together. And yeah. wow, we are not smart people. And well-read, we're not educated. And he and I were talking about it the other day. And I said, so how much do you expect as far as like revenue? Like, what are you going to, and I'm going to bring a following. And he's 50-50. And I said, dude, you're bringing nobody. Nobody's. And he goes, yeah, but are you in or are you out? You know, my years of business school, you know, I was like, I guess I'm in, you know? So clearly I've signed up for something that, you know, in the future, if I happen to do a podcast, it'll probably be about complete nonsense. and we'll get paid substantially well and half of it. So, you know, so.
Well, hey, there's a place for complete nonsense. We devolve into that pretty regularly right here.
We appreciate it.
Yeah. But if there's a Joey Votto podcast, I will listen to that. Just so you know. So you'll have, you'll have one listener.
At least two listeners, right? For sure.
Depends on like if we start, you know, some of those podcasts out there, they talk about some wild, wild stuff. You guys get into politics and stuff like that on there?
No.
Not really. Social periodically, but yeah, I mean, I could see like a Votto's world. It'd be cool. Like, you know, basketball, you cover a lot of stuff, man. Interesting in that way. You have a lot of interest. You're a deep thinker. I think you could do some real fun stuff.
I looked at my high school report card the other day and I am not a deep thinker. Not a smart.
Sure. Those are just grades though. We're talking about like, you don't need the grades to prove your deep thought. I think you got it. I'd 100% bring you in as a guest in my class. 100%.
Really?
So if you ever want to do that, sure. Good. They'd have a lot to gain from you.
It would be an honor. It would be an honor. Thanks for having me today.
Hey, yeah, listen, thanks, Joe. It was awesome to have you, man. Go spread some fun, get healthy. Can't wait to have you back. Thanks for making time for us, Joey.
Of course. Thanks, guys.
Guys tend to think looking sharp means starchy Oxfords and stiff chinos rather than effortless comfort, but it's possible to have it both ways. I'm all set for summer thanks to Mack Weldon. The Vesper polo shirt is so breathable you can wear it on the golf course, but it looks classy enough to wear to a party. The Maverick Tech chino short is ultra flexible, and the Pima crew neck t-shirt is perfect for those casual weekends. There's no need to be uncomfortable in your clothing ever again. Some guys just want to look good without calling attention to themselves. Mack Weldon apparel gives you understated good looks for understated confidence. Mack Weldon clothes are designed to fit your style and the demands of modern life. They look like regular clothes, but feel like the latest in modern comfort. They're the go-to choice for guys who want to look great without even trying. Breathable underwear that keeps you cool, dry, and comfy all day. Crazy comfortable but elevated sweatpants. An upgraded classic polo with antimicrobial silver threads. An ultra-soft antimicrobial tee for when you need to stay fresh longer. That's the Silver Crew Neck T-shirt. Get timeless looks with modern comfort from Mack Weldon. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code MLBSHOW. That's MackWeldon.com. Promo code MLB Show.
When you get injured, you don't want to wait for answers and options. That's why it may be time to explore the Nano Experience, a revolutionary treatment option designed to help active people get back to the lifestyles they love. Nanotechnology allows surgeons to see inside even the smallest joints and treat orthopedic conditions with a tiny camera and other nano instrumentation, all through a barely there poke hole incision. Wherever you've experienced an injury, whether it be a foot and ankle, hand and wrist, shoulder and elbow, knee or hip, nanoarthroscopy can be used to diagnose and treat your condition in an extremely, minimally invasive way. Don't wait to learn about the revolutionary Nano Experience and how it could help you or someone you know after an injury. Visit arthrex.info/theathletic. This is not medical advice and is not meant to be a substitute for advice from your physician. Talk with your physician about your health condition, potential surgical risks, and whether Arthrex products are right for you. Postoperative management is patient-specific and dependent upon your physician's assessment. Individual results will vary.
All right, Doug, we successfully dodged trivia on our Labor Day show last week, but apparently we're not allowed to avoid this stuff for more than 1 week. So here we go. Listener trivia is back. And here's some good news, Doug. Our guest this week has stumped us before. I know that excites you, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And we needed to take a week off. We were on the IL, you know, just recovering.
No.
And I think rehab went well, and I'm ready to go again. Yeah, back in the lineup.
Okay. You know, it's not that exclusive a club of people who have stumped us before, but nevertheless, we're impressed by anybody who does it. And this week, we're bringing back Adam Kane. So, Adam, thank you for joining us to torment us again.
Thank you guys for having me back.
Yeah, you are welcome. Adam, remind us where you're located, who you're a fan of, how you got into this Starkville queue.
So I'm in South Carolina right now. I grew up in North Carolina and grew up a Cubs fan by way of WGN. So Cubs are still my team. Right now it's maybe not as fun as it was a few years ago, but I'm hopeful for the future.
Yeah. Well, now, what part of North Carolina? I have a ton of family in North Carolina.
I grew up in the Charlotte area and then went to school in Raleigh, NC State.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know Cameron Park?
Oh, yeah.
Yep. We lived there for 2 years.
Nice. Yeah, that's right by the university.
Yep, right there. Very cool. Very cool. Now, I noticed you're wearing a Ryobi shirt. What's the story there?
So that's where I work now. I'm an engineer for Ryobi Power Tools. Been doing that for a couple of years and I love it.
So if you're a Cubs fan, you're probably a huge Doug Glanville fan at some point in your life.
Of course. Yeah. My early baseball memories involve a certain triple in the playoffs or something that I don't know.
you were walking at that point, right? I mean, I'm not that old, right? I mean, how old were you then?
Yeah, that was that 03? Is that right?
03, yeah.
Yeah, so I was 5 years old.
Oh, yeah. That's good.
Very beginning of my when I really got into baseball.
He's just heard way too much talk about that triple. It comes up like 12 times a year. It's incredible.
Yeah, that's no, we need to put on loop. It's very important. Yeah,
you're milking that thing, Glanville. Anyway, Adam, I think we actually have a shot at your question for a change. But before we get to that, I do have one more question for you. It looks like about half of your tweets over the last year have been trivia questions for us. So I'm going to take that as an indication we're your favorite podcast in America. And Doug and I are obviously your two favorite people to follow on Twitter. You want to confirm that?
Yeah, I don't tweet much, so it's just for worthy causes, I guess.
Yeah, appreciate it.
Doesn't get any more worthy than stumping us with trivia. So, all right, listen, your questions are always so good. Why don't you hit us with this one?
All right. Can you name the three players with the most career home runs that have never hit 50 or more in a season?
I think we can. You know, I actually love this, Doug. I think it's obviously inspired by that Albert Pujols guy closing in on the 700 homer club. I actually feel like Albert is one of the answers. Doug, did Albert ever hit 50?
I don't think so. And that's why I feel, you know, I always think of Albert Bell, you know, 50,
wrong Albert.
50. Or, yeah, the wrong Albert. So therefore, by default or elimination, yeah, I think Albert Pujols, I don't recall him ever hitting 50.
Yeah.
So, yeah, a lot of 40s, 30s, 40s.
Right. So, I mean, I can't believe we can't remember for sure, but I do think Albert is one of these. I also know, like, a second one is Henry Aaron. That's a legendary trivia question. I've been asked it many times. You know, most home runs without hitting more than 40, whatever. Henry Aaron. So I think we actually have two of the three right off the bat in Pujols and Aaron. That never happens. So if we're right, that means we only need one more. The other guys in the 600 homer club have all hit 50, right? Like Bonds, Ruth, A-Rod, Mays, we know Sammy Sosa has, Jim Tomey hit 50, so that's the 600 homer club. If we go into the high 500s, obviously Mark McGwire hit way more than 50. I think that brings us to Frank Robinson. Now, I'm doing all of this from memory. I haven't looked at the the 500 Homer Club. I promise I didn't cheat, but I have spent a lot of time in my life, and especially recently because of Albert, looking at all these guys with 500 and 600 and 700 homers. If I remember right, Frank Robinson hit 586 and never hit 50. So he would be my third guess. But I know that you thought of this, Doug. Anyone you think we're missing?
Well, I actually know someone definitively. That's why I asked the question about the ranking, because Michael Jack Schmidt never hit 50. Yeah, right? He hit 48 or something. 48.
Yeah, right. So Frank Robinson never would have had more than him.
Right. So that's the only, you know, and I don't have any confidence on, I don't know about Frank, but I know about Mike Schmidt. So I think we're right there. You know, we've got 3 out of 4, 4 out of 3, you know. but I don't know. Frank, I'll go with Frank because I don't know how to refute that.
All right. Now, see, our only worry here is if we were wrong about Albert, then we would need to think about Schmidt. But I just like Schmidt's the idea of guessing Aaron, Pujols, and Robinson. That's a great group. So you good with that, Doug?
I'm good with it. Yeah, I'm good with that. And worst case scenario, we listen to a Mike Schmidt audio tape at the end of this trivia.
you enjoy that? All right, Adam. Is there any chance that we actually got this right?
You sure did. Congratulations.
Oh, my God. How about that? Do you even remember the last time we got one right? Was it like January? Was it like 2008? Like,
I didn't have any gray hair. I had no gray hair in my head, so it was
wild. Let's ask the mayor. Mayor Tim, do you have any idea when we last got one of these right?
Well, we got the Vin Scully. We got the Vin Scully. That was our last one. With the El Presidente, El Perfecto.
Oh, yeah.
Overall, since the season started, 4 for 20. So 200. Back at the Mendoza line. Just like that.
Yeah. But if you win 4 World Series out of 20, you're golden.
No. If we were 4 for 20 in the season, we'd get released.
Well, unless all today. Four
not
were today. Homers.
Not if your OPS is if they're all homers, you are in the Hall of Fame. Right. You're in the Hall of Fame.
Right. Then our launch angle would be in great shape. But so look, 4 for 20, that's the bad news. You know what the good news is? We've reached the portion of the segment where the mayor, Tim McMaster, pops in and plays another fabulous piece of play-by-play involving this week's answer. So I know Tim was scrambling to get this ready. Tim, what do you got for us?
All right, we're going to go with Frank Robinson. Originally, I wanted to get, he homered in game one of the 1966 World Series.
Wow.
1966 is when he hit 49 homers. So that was his 50th home run of that season. I couldn't find that audio. So we're going with Frank Robinson's 500th career home run.
Here we go. Looks to check Powell at first. Delivers. Fly ball. Well hit. Deep left field. It is going to be the 500th home run of a brilliant major league career. Frank Robinson has done it.
Always fun to listen to Frank Robinson go deep, huh? That doesn't happen much anymore. Hey, Adam, fun question, man. Thanks for being such a loyal listener, Twitter, and trivia contestant. So come back again, okay?
All right. Thank you guys so much again for having me.
Good work.
Thanks, Adam. Keep the engineering prod going.
I will.
Strange but true.
I've been looking forward to this Strange But True segment all day. You'll find out why in a moment. But because, as is so often the case, there's more to this fun little tidbit than meets the eye. We have a special Glanville connection, you see, but we'll get to that. Since it's Reds week, apparently here at Starkville, this week's Strange But True involves a rookie for the Reds, Spencer Steer. He made his major league debut about a week ago, Doug, and his first career at bat was something we haven't seen much. It lasted 10 pitches. Let's hear a little taste of how it turned out.
10th pitch of the plate appearance. There's ball four. Spencer Steer's debut begins with a walk.
And that's just a great at bat right there. I think the biggest thing for a debut is harnessing emotion. And he looked like he did a very nice job of doing just that.
I thought he looked calm.
Yes.
I agree with Barry Larkin. That's a great job right there. So how about that? In the first trip to the plate of this guy's career, he worked a 10-pitch walk. And Doug, I know you're thinking, how often does that happen? That about right?
Yeah, I always go with zero to be safe, maybe -1 sometimes.
It does happen, but I didn't look this up myself. Our friend Joel Luckhaupt, who comes up with lots of great stats on the Reds, told me that Spencer Steer was the first player to see at least 10 pitches in his first career plate appearance and reach base since, are you ready? This guy was a pitcher. Cole Irvin somehow drew a 10-pitch walk for the Phillies. This was back on May 17th, 2019. And I just want to fill you in now. Spencer Steer went on to have an amazing first game in the big leagues. He reached base 4 times. He scored the winning run on a walk-off. And in his first official at-bat, so this is the trip to the plate after the walk, he hit a home run. And so you should know, too, Doug, that's the first home run ever by a Steer. So I looked up home runs by Bulls, like Greg the Bull Luzinski, looked that up. I looked up home runs by Cows, Colin Cowgill came to mind. And then I decided I would draw the line and not look up Mookie's. Is that okay?
Mookie. Yeah, I mean, well, you know, Adnan Verk and I used to talk about Mookie Betts. Is, you know, we did the old Johnny Carson thing. Mookie Betts is when a cow tries to check into a hotel at Vegas. That's how we did it. So, that's right. You know,
exactly,
yeah.
Exactly right. But we digress because I want to get to the strange but true part of this. I looked up the career of a former big leaguer named Doug Glanville. And our man Glanville, he played 9 seasons in the big leagues, right? Mm-hmm. He came to the plate more than 4,000 times. Am I right?
Yeah, it was a lot of times.
So how many times did that Doug Glanville draw a walk in an at-bat that lasted 10 pitches or more?
You almost don't need the comma. You can just stop. How many times did he draw a walk and just stop there? But yes. 10 pitches, I don't even know.
Okay, let's say
not a lot.
The answer is exactly once. So Spencer Steer did it in his very first trip to the plate. Glanville, 4,000 trips to the plate once. Doug, what do you have to say for yourself?
Yeah, well, I'm curious how many times Steer will do that going forward, see if it's something anomaly.
No. What do you have to say for yourself?
Well, I mean, look, here's the thing. Like, first of all, I see it as a skill to not foul balls off. I mean, you know, so that's the thing. You have to foul some stuff off.
Oh, yeah.
So if you have a skill of hitting it into play, there's got to be some bonus. It's not my fault that I didn't know how to foul a ball off. The bat angle always put the ball between the white lines, which can be very bad when you're not playing well. But, you know, so I, you know, then I think it's like walking, you know, it's not that exciting. First of all, if your name is Spencer Steer, you should not have to walk in life. All right. You either drive a car since you're steering, or you ride cattle from home to first base. That would be honoring your name. That's how you would honor your name. So I'm disappointed he decided to walk to first base, which is unexciting, very boring. Live up to your name, man.
He steered himself right to first base.
Yeah, he got to be a country singer too. Yeah, well, Cole Irvin, right? Irvin and Spencer Steer. That's a duo on the country music circuit
really is.
So let's just call it what it is.
It really should be. And at some point, let's see, should we get Miranda Lambert? To sing with them, it'd be beautiful. It really would.
Yeah, lambs.
Yeah.
Yep, I like it.
All right, look, we're getting way far afield here because I'm just reaching the fun part. Do you remember your only 10-pitch walk?
Wow. Was it against the Mets, maybe?
No.
Okay. I don't think I do, actually.
All right, let me refresh your memory. It was... Okay. August 6th, 2004. So this is one of the last games of your career. You'd already been to the plate 4,000 times before you did this once. Okay. So Kaz Ishii was the pitcher. You led off the top of the second inning at Dodger Stadium. And I'll tell you what, thanks to Baseball Reference, I can actually run through the at-bat with you. You want to hear this?
Yeah. All right. What happened?
Ball one, called strike. So for some reason, you took two pitches in a row. Then you took a third. So it's two.
Oh, my gosh.
And one.
You must have been sick.
All right. Now, here we go. Foul. 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 Ball three. Whoa. Another foul. What's that? That's five fouls, right? Followed by
a bad day.
Ball four. You remember any of this?
What? I thought I hit a home run, but yeah, ball four. Wow.
Remember any of this?
A good curveball. No, I remember. Well, the thing about him is I hit him. He was a guy that was very frustrating because I hit him hard and I always lined out to somebody.
Yeah. Likely
it's one of the few times I had to throw my helmet down the corridor of Veterans Stadium because I was like, I keep hitting this guy hard and they're just everywhere. Now, of course, today with the shift, that would have been more true. But I don't know. Did I ever get a hit off that guy? I mean, it's just, I don't know what the numbers
say. I didn't look that part up. I'm going to try to jog your memory about this game, though, because I think you remember the game. Here's what happened next. Marlon Byrd hit a home run. So it was a two-run homer. You got to score. And you guys wound up winning this game in the 11th inning. You had a huge rally in the 11th off the Cy Young winner, Eric Gagne. Do you remember any of that? He gave up more runs in that inning than he'd given up the whole previous season. You don't remember any of this?
I remember the floating head that, you know, when he... when you'd come in, the Dodgers scoreboard had this like creepy
You're
floating head.
You're changing the subject. Good. You don't remember any of this.
I know I got a bunt hit off him and a base hit off his curveball, but I don't know if it was that.
You struck out in that inning, but
forget it.
Sometimes I think I remember more about your career than you do. Why would that be?
Yeah, you know, selective memory. That's very important in this game. You have to pick your memories.
I just pointed out a career highlight, something you did one time. You don't have any memory of it at all. My God.
Walks were disappointments. They were disappointments. I wanted to put the bat on the ball.
Okay. That's going to do it for this week's show. We'll be bringing you podcast magic just like this all season long on the Athletic Baseball Show, which is available in its entirety, absolutely free, everywhere you get your podcasts. If you'd like to read any of the spectacular writing in The Athletic, we can also tell you how to do that. If you go to theathletic.com/baseball show, and if you're a new subscriber, you still have access to our greatest special, $1 a month for the next 6 months. But also remember, you too can be part of this podcast, just like Adam Kane was a little while ago. Every show, we pick some fun listener trivia question, then that listener gets to join us right here on the pod to prove once again that there's almost no baseball trivia question we can't get wrong, despite what just happened this week. So to do that, how could you contact us with your trivia? You could always email us at starkville@theathletic.com, or you can hit us with your questions on Twitter. So if somebody was looking for Doug Glanville on Twitter, is that even possible?
It is. It is. You can find me. Do a search if you feel like it, but that's too much work. Just go at Doug Glanville, DougGlanville. That's it.
Excellent spelling every week from Glanville. You don't even have to spell my whole name. It's at Jason, StJaySonST. Two things. Please hashtag the questions. Hashtag StarkvilleQS. That's one. Number two, when other people ask trivia of us, do not answer those questions on the Twitter machine, okay? It just ruins the whole concept. So, Doug, thanks for playing. Thanks to Joey Votto for joining us. Thanks to Adam Kane for the great trivia question. Thanks to the mayor of Starkville, Tim McMaster, for producing us and putting up with us. And thanks to you all for listening. Tomorrow it is Roundtable Day here on the Athletic Baseball Show. And Doug and I will see you next Tuesday. On Starkville.
Almost.